Hey guys, it's Brandon from the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. At MacroOps, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm Data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, MARHELM.com to get your discount today. This is Greenhaven Road Capital's Q4 2023 letter. Dear fellow investors, the fund returned approximately 15% in the fourth quarter, bringing the full year returns to approximately 51%. Returns will vary by fund and investment class, so please check your statements for actual returns. Our Q2 letter was themed around being one day closer. I wrote, quote, "I believe that with each passing day, we are one day closer. These improvements will not always be reflected in share prices, and many times progress will not be linear, but time is the friend of a strong management team, and time is the friend of the competitively advantaged businesses. Time is our friend." Close quote. I would like to say that all of our Q4 returns were generated because of our patience and our waiting for the one day to pass, but I do not think that that is the full explanation. We benefited from multiple expansion during the quarter as investors were willing to pay a higher PE or price to sales for the same underlying company. Building a business takes decades, but changes in pricing multiples can happen in an instant. The multiples for the stocks we own expanded in the fourth quarter as interest rates cuts became a credible possibility for most market participants in 2024. Fortunately, in addition to multiple expansion, several of our companies also took some very large steps forward, as I will discuss throughout this letter. Multiple expansion and contraction amplify price movements, but there has been progress in the business building, which is what will matter over the long term most. Pay attention to what? Recently, podcaster Tim Ferriss interviewed Apollo Robbins, the world's most famous pickpocket. The episode is wide-ranging, but, spoiler alert, not really about pickpocketing. Rather, they focus on how attention can be misappropriated. For Munger fans, he even cites Robert Cialdini, the author of Influence, The Power of Persuasion, a book Munger liked so much he gifted Cialdini a share of Berkshire Hathaway. For me, listening to the podcast led to reading an article from The New Yorker and viewing a related video, which led to watching Robin's TED Talk on the art of misdirection, which resulted in a YouTube feed full of pickpocket demonstrations. Unlike magicians, people like Apollo Robbins, who pickpocket as a form of entertainment, are willing to discuss their strategies and techniques. Their craft involves predicting human behavior and controlling slash misdirecting the tension. As a viewer of this genre, we know that there will be one or more steals, but even when we are looking for and expecting the grab, it is still hard to see when it happens. The combination of multiple viewings, the ability to rewind, and step-by-step explanation of various techniques for framing attention reveals how the mark is distracted. The videos are bite-sized reminders of how susceptible we are to paying attention to the wrong details. In Apollo Robbins' case, every mark knows they are part of a pickpocketing demonstration. Many have seen his videos before, their attention levels are at 110%, and all warning systems are activated. Yet they are still unaware when personal items get removed. The act of paying attention is not enough to save them, and in some cases, the mark's heightened attention is used against them. Where we pay attention and how we pay attention can have a profound effect on the outcome. As Charlie Munger said, the whole trick in life is to get so that your own brain doesn't mislead you. While it is tempting to explore what pickpockets can teach us about the fraudulent side of investing, such as Enron's fake accounting or Nikola's management team pretending that a truck rolling down a hill was powered by their engine that actually did not work, for our style of investing, I see three setups involving investor attention where we can potentially profit over the long term. The following are names I am personally ascribing to these setups. These names do not appear in investing textbooks, but I think they are apt descriptions. The first is macro takes over, the second is short-termism, and the third is don't know, don't care. I will briefly describe each of these, how some of the tenets of Greenhaven Road apply to counteracting them, and how we might profit from them over time. Personally, I believe the hardest periods as a fundamental investor come when all the attention is shifted away from the companies themselves to the macroeconomy and or the general geopolitical landscape. When the entire market is swinging based on the expected words of the Federal Reserve Chairman or the troop movements in a country such as Ukraine, large price movements are disconnected from what is actually happening at the companies we own. When Russia invaded Ukraine, markets swooned. Several of our companies had zero revenue in Ukraine and the surrounding area, yet their share prices moved materially. The macro periods are so difficult because they are accompanied by rapid repricing of the multiples that investors are willing to pay for future earnings. Bad things happen, investors are skittish, multiples go from 20 to 18, and boom, the stocks we own are down 10%. In macro-focused periods, the multiple can expand or collapse overnight, while the business's earnings can be unchanged. Though the multiple will drive performance over the shorter term, fortunately, it is the business progress that determines the true long-term returns. If a company can compound earnings at 15% for 20 years, they will have grown earnings by 16x. The business growth should have a far greater impact on the returns than the beginning or ending multiple. It is during these periods when the entire focus is on the macro that I repeat the mantra of fundamentals matter. Earnings matter, and the quality of those earnings matter. Cash flow matters, growth matters. How the growth is achieved matters. Fundamentals may not matter when the world goes risk off and everything is sold, but over time, paying attention to fundamentals is essential in discerning quality in which companies have the chance to grow earnings at elevated levels for years through all of the macro challenges such as wars, interest rate changes, and pandemics. The second area where a lot of investor attention can be misallocated is the very short term. This short-termism has several manifestations, including quarterly earnings estimates. Having sat in the COO, CFO, and board seats of operating businesses, I'm always skeptical of how meaningful it really is to beat or miss earnings in any quarter. There is an investment bank that includes the last 12 quarters of data on how much the company has beat or missed consensus earnings and what the stock price movement on earnings day was. This earnings day price movement analysis is a prominent part of every research report they distribute to their customers. On earnings calls, a disproportionate amount of the question and answer session is spent on questions that are effectively trying to dial in individual variables for a financial model, such as gross margin, to adjust the next quarter's estimates by a penny or two. As I listen to these calls, I'm reminded of the Jeff Bezos quote, "When somebody congratulates Amazon on a good quarter, I say thank you. But what I'm thinking to myself is, those quarterly results were actually pretty much fully baked about 3 years ago. Who am I to question one of the richest men in the world and a Hall of Fame operator?" In my experience at smaller companies, the baking happens more like 1 to 1.5 years in advance of the quarterly announcement, not 3. Nevertheless, the larger point still holds. Current earnings are an output of actions taken months and years ago. Products are not built overnight. The sales process for a new customer is measured in months and years. Acquisitions take quarters to execute, and integrating those acquisitions takes years. To avoid short-termism, I'm intentional about my information diet, the investors I spend time with, the types of questions that I ask management teams, and most importantly, who we invest with. In our Q4 2020 letter, I wrote about the concept of Fight Club, a term I believe was applied to investment purposes by Dan McMurtry of Tyro Partners. At that time, I wrote that, quote, instead of thinking of a company as a group of assets managed by people, I think we're actually investors in a group of people managing assets. Those people are engaged in a series of fights with competitors while trying to scare off potential new entrants. Handicapping the fight is highly dependent on management, but also existing assets, product positioning, balance sheets, and industry structure. These fights can be lopsided or drag on, leaving both parties bloody to a pulp. We want to own the strongest fighters in the easiest fights, or the most underrated fighter with the best chance of surprising the lumbering, overconfident incumbents. We are investing in people. We are trying to invest with management teams that have significant ownership aligning to our interests. We are not going to have full transparency into the activities today that are driving the results in 2025 and 2026, but the management teams do. We don't want to go into Fight Club with a manager with a history of misdirection. We cannot afford to be using our limited attention to protect our wallets at all times. As trite as it sounds, people really matter, and instead of myopically focusing on this quarter's earnings estimates, I would rather assess the members of the management team, their internal investments of time, people, and capital, and their likelihood of bearing fruit in the future. I believe that the third area of investing that provides opportunity for us is don't know, don't care. While our partnership's investments mandate is broad, in the last several years, we have not owned a single company in the S&P 500, instead skewing towards much smaller companies, ones that I would argue most people don't know and don't care. Many of our investments don't screen well, as the full opportunity is not laid out in the historical financial statements. A significant portion of the market is passive dollars, such as indices. They do not even pretend to look or care. Then there are sell-side analysts who are paid to look, but they are covering 30-plus companies in a time-compressed way that very much focuses on quarterly earnings, and often their work is riddled with errors one might expect if somebody stretched too thin. For example, on the day I'm writing this letter, an analyst published a report on a company we own that is selling one of its divisions. The analyst properly removed the earnings from that division in their analysis, but forgot to adjust the debt-to-cash levels from the proceeds, impacting their price target by more than 50%. Over the past several years, just buying the largest companies has been rewarded, but I believe that over time, understanding the accounting of Cellebrite matters and will be rewarded. I believe that understanding that PAR could sign very large customers 9 months before one was announced matters. I believe that the work we have done to understand Burford and their portfolio of cases besides YPF matters. In a land of don't know, don't care, I care. I care like a person investing my life savings into these companies. It can be very lonely in periods of risk off where macro dominates or when others don't know, don't care. But ultimately, I believe we are rewarded. We will be rewarded for spending our attention in some of the boring corners of capitalism where we can have an informational advantage just by doing the work. Top 5 holdings. Because I've written about all our top 5 holdings extensively in previous letters, this letter's discussion of them will have greater focus on the seeds that management is planting today that I believe may drive results in 1 or 2 years. This is a speculative exercise, but may be more instructive than highlighting the most recent accomplishments. PAR Technology, PAR. In October, our largest holding, PAR, announced their biggest customer win, Burger King. The path to Burger King was long and winding. One could argue that the first seeds were planted in 2014 when the company bought a cloud-based point-of-sale system called Brink. However, it would also not have happened if CEO Savneet Singh had not been hired in 2018. It would also not have happened if the company had not decided to pursue their United Commerce strategy in 2021. This overnight success was almost 10 years in the making, and a series of product hiring and acquisition decisions. I see two sources for optimism for us as shareholders. The first is that even though the Burger King announcement was the largest in company history and represents 8,000 Burger King locations, there are also many reasons to believe that the two other large chains, Tim Hortons and Popeyes, with the same owners as Burger King, could be secured if the Burger King implementation is successful, representing an additional 8,000 locations and then eventually international Burger Kings. None of the Burger King, Tim Hortons, Popeyes international opportunity shows up in the quarterly earnings right now. Fortunately, there may be more large chains behind Burger King. As the CEO of PAR said, quote, what makes us even more positive is that we believe we're just at the beginning of a tidal wave of large deals coming to market, which should provide for long-term sustainable growth. Close quote. To quantify this, PAR has more RFPs due in the first 4 months of 2024 than they had in all of 2023. There are 6 Tier 1 restaurants in play. Based on some triangulation, parsing of words, scuttlebutt, and logic, my best guess is that PAR has won a chain that starts with a W and ends with a Y for their Punch loyalty program. I can predict that on the next earnings call, the majority of questions will be about gross margins for the past quarter and expenses for the coming quarter. I believe the reality is that if the competitive landscape remains favorable versus NCR and Oracle, if PAR can deliver on their unified commerce platform, and if there are opportunistic acquisitions, our patience should be rewarded. The combination of an enterprise-scale POS, plus payments, plus menu, plus loyalty, plus back office is resonating with customers. Payments are better because of POS integration. POS and loyalty are better because of payments integration. Almost all customers buying menu take payments. The products are reinforcing. As I've mentioned in several letters, I'm paying particular attention to the jockey here. Savneet Singh has an excellent track record of product development and capital allocation, and I think many of the pieces will come together in 2024 with an acquisition that is accretive and provides scale, the sale of PAR's government business, and increased operating leverage. With these changes, I believe the company can end 2024 as more of a pure-play software company with very attractive financial metrics. Specifically, the combination of revenue growth, 30% plus on ARR, profit growth, and multiple expansion should yield a higher share price. KKR. The alternative asset manager laid out some of the seeds of growth they have planted at the Goldman Sachs conference last December, stating that, quote, there's a lot of different ways to grow the firm, Asia, climate, infrastructure, insurance, private credit, private wealth. These are all the things we've been building over the last several years that are now starting to have a really big impact on the firm. And so that's part of the reason you hear such optimism from us, close quote. On their last earnings call, management said, quote, we continue to be added to more private wealth platforms as these vehicles ramp. 2 years ago, we were on 10 platforms, and today that number is closer to 40 across the suite of products that we manage, with more to come. They are now raising approximately $500 million a month. It's really a strong start for us, especially relative to our expectations, only reinforcing our confidence in the scale and impact of the long-term opportunity here. Close quote. In December, KKR doubled down on insurance, purchasing the remainder of Global Atlantic, which has historically focused on managing assets for the insurance industry. They also have a 200-person sales force focused on selling into the private wealth channel. Private wealth is barely moving the needle today, but this is an asset-gathering business, and the machine is being built. Yes, there is a limit to how much more money endowments and other institutions can allocate to private equity, but the private wealth engine is just starting and should be able to drive meaningful growth for a decade plus. KKR has also been changing its share structure and governance to qualify for the S&P 500. This should occur in 2024 and provide a nice one-time tailwind as a wave of passive money is forced to buy KKR shares. Celebrate, CLBT. The company sells software tools to law enforcement agencies to collect and review data from cell phones, benefiting from the increasing types and volumes of data, including geolocation, photos, text, emails, and social media. Celebrite has built a wonderful business and is the scaled provider with a limited competitive landscape. One of their competitors was bought out by Thoma Bravo and has proceeded to increase prices in certain geographies by 30% plus. I think Celebrite will pull the price lever over the next 3 years, but do it in a more subtle way through new products with greater functionality. This is an ongoing process. They are rolling out their new Insight product, which is designed to sell more seats. They should also continue to gain traction with their case management and Pathfinder analytics products. As an example, Pathfinder, which helps make sense of all the data, now has a 30% attach rate, but only a mid-single-digit penetration rate. I believe that cross-sells of Pathfinder will fuel growth. Law enforcement agencies are struggling with case closure rates, backlogs, and hiring technologically sophisticated employees, all while facing an ever-growing wave of data, priming the market for new products, cross-sells, and price increases. Selling new products with increased functionality for higher prices should satisfy customers and fuel growth. In the short term, I think it is quite possible that the market will begin to appreciate the quality of the Celebrite business. Their products are truly mission critical, their competitive landscape is limited, the value proposition is high, and there is a pricing umbrella. The company's net dollar retention has consistently been above 120%. CLBT trades at 4x EV/CY 2024 ARR. A significant discount to peer group average of more than 7x. Like PAR, we have the opportunity for revenue growth, earnings growth, and multiple expansion in 2024. API Group, APG. API Group is one of the more difficult companies we own to analyze from the outside. Fortunately, the demand for their core fire inspection and repair business is very stable, as fire inspections are statutory and required by law for a building to be used. API uses their inspection business to drive their repair business, which is also largely non-discretionary. A landlord can tolerate a leaky roof for a while, but it has to repair a broken sprinkler system immediately. The improvements of API's business come through thousands of small actions, including winning new customers, improving route density for their trucks, and managing purchases throughout their supply chain. The company is digesting a large European acquisition and will realize the benefits of price increases and relief from supply chain disruptions. API Group has a core competency in successfully acquiring and integrating companies, as they've made hundreds of acquisitions. As their debt levels are reduced towards their target of 2.5x, which they anticipate to have achieved in the most recent quarter, the company can continue the playbook of value accretive M&A and other capital allocation opportunities. While API is the number one player in the fire protection systems market with 5% market share, the competitive environment is highly fragmented and conducive to acquisitions and roll-ups. Like PAR, API is another overnight success that was 10 years in the making. Originally focused on contract-centric business, the company made the strategic shift to a recurring revenue model focused more on servicing fire safety systems than initial installation. Between 2007 and 2022, the more attractive inspection, servicing, and monitoring business grew from 15% of revenue to 50%. But the company isn't stopping there and is targeting a 60% plus mix look ahead. A business with high recurring revenue, resiliency to the overall economy, and expanding margins through operating leverage should be assigned a higher multiple. With API Group, we don't need multiple expansion to do well, as organic revenue growth and incremental growth through M&A will accrue to earnings growth that alone should generate attractive returns. Multiple expansion would be a cherry on top. Burford, B-U-R. The litigation finance company is by definition playing the long game, as their average case takes almost 3 years from funding to resolution, but may take significantly longer. As a result, earnings in 3 years are really being driven by the investments made today. The two senior managers at Burford each own more than $100 million worth of stock. They're building an asset management business. Two of management's priorities with long-term implications are to continue to build out both their data science infrastructure and their customer base. Historically, the deal pipeline of cases came from law firms looking to get their legal work paid for by Burford so that clients were more likely to pursue their cases. Increasingly, large companies are coming to Burford with cases as a case financed by Burford allows management to pursue a case without hurting current year earnings and their current year bonuses. Burford is currently working with two Fortune 50 companies. Working directly with corporates is going to be important for continuing to grow the litigation and financing business. Like the rest of Burford's investment base, I am paying attention to their Argentina YPF case because, if and when they can collect their judgment, the potential proceeds exceed the market capitalization of the company. The developments with the new Argentinian president are incrementally positive. We are also tracking several other material cases, including Cisco, and any indications of continued progress on the corporate front. As discussed in our investor presentation to investors only that accompanied our last letter, Burford's business is one where power laws can come into play. In general, they earn good returns on average for meat and potatoes type cases, but have the potential to earn incredible returns on a smaller basket of cases, which can have outsized impacts on valuation. Shorts. We remain short the flying taxi company that has the trifecta of regulatory risk, technology risk, and business model risk, and you could arguably throw in a healthy dose of execution risk. Shares were up in 2023, but I do not think time is the friend of this business. We are short an EV manufacturer that delivered 6,000 vehicles last year. This is a subscale manufacturer that loses money with each car sold. In an increasing competitive marketplace with declining prices, it seems hard to justify a $10 billion valuation at the end of the year. We are short two companies facing significant litigation with the potential for treble damages for their actions and potential liabilities far in excess of their market caps. The litigation will take time to play out, but given the low margins, commodity nature of their product, and capital intensity, it is an unlikely candidate for a GameStop-type short squeeze, and I believe has the potential to decline by 50% or more. We are also short three major indices and bought some insurance in the form of out-of-the-money options in late December when options prices made the risk-reward more palatable. The puts will soften the blow of any major decline in equity prices and are both an insurance policy and allow us to remain invested in the turbulent times. Outlook. I have little doubt that in 2024, we will see the return of the dynamics discussed in this letter. There will be periods where macro dominates. There will continue to be short-termism. And despite my best efforts to spread the word, much of what we will own will be solidly in don't-know, don't-care land. This is an election year in the U.S., which will naturally distract investors from the fundamentals as poll results and debate answers are extrapolated into potential policies far into the future. But as I wrote in the last letter, we have had multiple 50% up years. The returns come in chunks. I don't know when the chunks are coming, but the gap between business progress and share price for our portfolio feels very wide. With each passing day, we are one day closer to our Fight Club building their businesses and landing their punches. Onwards, Scott. This is Greenwood Investors Q4 2023 letter. Fundamental momentum. We are pleased to report a year of good progress for our investors as collaborative and constructive engagements added considerable value to our performance. Even still, we are not satisfied. We remain hungry and curious. We're looking for more businesses to bring our active approach to. In terms of 2023 returns, our separate accounts, which remain open to any investor, returned 28%. For fund returns, please see our results page to check on that performance, which was modestly better than this result. Importantly, this was achieved without any of the exposure to overvalued large technology companies, which generated more than half of our equity benchmark's returns this past year. Furthermore, much of our portfolio is outside the U.S. and even in investor-despised Europe, which has just hit an unprecedented value discount relative to the U.S., where investors remain enamored with the most recent fad in Silicon Valley. While it was a good year for our returns, in all cases except one, the business fundamentals have outpaced the share price performance. This is the opposite story to the broader benchmarks where valuations have borrowed from the future with valuation expansion. In contrast, our margin of safety has improved as free cash flow growth in the portfolio outstripped our performance. Our ability to sustain this momentum is underpinned by excellent managers guiding underappreciated companies through transformational moments in their history. These managers behave like owners. They are not managing for the quarter or even for the year. They are managing for long-term business prosperity. Even still, our top six positions, accounting for 74% of our accounts and funds net exposure, grew free cash flow per share by 39.7% in 2023 using consensus estimates. If we were an alternative asset management firm, given multiples have expanded in each of the industries our top investments are in, we would have reported blistering mark-to-model returns. Despite widespread agreement that private assets remain significantly mismarked, we find it strange that this mark-to-myth model has not yet lost investors' confidence. Instead, many continue to underwrite new capital commitments based on the latest fad that Silicon Valley has captured imaginations with, or interest rates that existed over 2 years ago. While public equity investors live with the last emotional stock price tick to measure performance, no matter how much this is divorced from the underlying fundamental momentum, we maintain more benefits than mark to myth investors. We take less risk. We don't have to risk significant portfolio and asset leverage. We have better margins of safety through lower valuations. We have less failure risk, and we have daily liquidity. Beyond these benefits, we also have the responsibility of living up to the high expectations of the market's "what have you done for me lately" attitude. While it's grueling, it demands top-level performance continuously. We welcome these demands. The downside of having only a long-term value creation focus is that it often removes the sense of urgency for us to ensure the near-term outlook is attractive as the long-term view. This is very hard. Simultaneously optimizing for two opposite time horizons requires balancing divergent priorities. Yet it ensures value creation isn't a long-shot, intangible dream in the distant future. When pressed on why he wouldn't want his luxury group to be privately held, Bernard Arnault pushed back in his 2001 interviews for the book La Passion Creative by highlighting the merits of remaining public. What I believe is that being listed brings a lot of positive things to a business for its development. So you have more of responsibility to a market and even vis-a-vis your management. You are constantly obliged to question yourself for satisfaction of the market and therefore your countless shareholders. You always have to justify your choices and your investments. In a private group, decisions are much less transparent to shareholders, even if they are numerous, and vis-a-vis a staff. A high sense of urgency accompanies most activist efforts. In fact, most of our last letter was dedicated to highlighting the builders in our portfolio that have a high sense of urgency. However, that's very different from our style of activism. What's very different from our style of activism is that we're not just focused on the short term. Rather, we are focused on the long-term prosperity of our companies while also ensuring the near term is as exciting as the long term. This also differentiated Arnault, who used private equity raider tactics to take control of his marquee brands. However, after winning control of these assets, rather than dress them up for a quick sale, he positioned them for long-term compounding. He articulated this balance he made between prudence and risk-taking that made his style look more like Silicon Valley founder-led businesses than any French business at the time. This duality between prudence and risk-taking mirrors a lot of the other dualities we've seen in other major value creators. Sergio Marchionne balanced short with long-term, finance and engineering, and luxury versus mass market. David Cote wrote extensively about prioritizing both short and long-term goals. Sir Martin Sorrell also discussed how he balances capital with culture. Over the past year, Sir Martin has gone through one of his most challenging years in his entire storied career, but we remain committed to his capital and culture effort to reimagine the ad agency model. While he spent the last year on culture, we suspect the emphasis is now shifting to capital, as he has recently started S4 Capital's first share repurchase program. Balancing culture and capital, prudence and risk-taking, short and long-term, and innumerable other dualities is what owner-managed businesses do best. Yet investment ideas do not always perfectly align with an owner-operator culture. Despite a total investable universe of multiple thousand companies with market caps over 1 billion, the owner-operator universe is still quite relatively small to the investable universe. For certain special situations outside of the owner-operator universe, we believe we can help bring a critical ownership mentality to the daily governance of those companies where only agents are in control. In doing so, we believe we are expanding the investable universe to areas where owners unfortunately no longer manage many businesses. We are grateful to be playing a role in three of these transformations that are building fundamental momentum, and doing so by balancing these competing dualities. Just as we mentioned, we are tripling down on our constructive activist efforts in December of 2022. We have been fortunate enough to have placed four directors at Leonardo LDO and are one of the owners that went on the board at MEI Pharma, MEIP. Good governance is a daily action for those with skin in the game. Working on behalf of the company's customers, employees, shareholders, and other stakeholders is a team effort and a constant effort. We love being part of it. It's reinforced by the small moments that speak volumes about the validity of our approach. I'd like to share a few moments from this past year that particularly stuck out to me and are very telling. We'll start with our three largest positions where we sit on the boards, which also coincidentally drove the lion's share of our portfolio returns for the year, with Leonardo contributing 17.7, CTT contributing 5.5, and MEI Pharma contributing 3.8. Expanding ownership cultures. Leonardo. When I first met the new CEO of Leonardo, Roberto Cingolani, I definitely butchered that, he told me that he would spend the company's capital like it was his own family's. Every month that has gone by, the company has faced a substantial number of cost and capital allocation decisions, as the European aerospace and defense is having its moment, being very active. Roberto has needed very little advice in these capital allocation decisions because he's already thinking like an owner. It's embedded into his mindset. While he doesn't have a controlling equity position in the company, he behaves even more rationally than others we've seen that do. He has a bias against cost and bureaucracy and is transforming Leonardo with a great sense of urgency. This upcoming March, investors will get to see the results of his first 9 months of the job. A year ago, the company's reputation with investors was the worst rated in the industry as measured by Brendan Wood International. We believe as more investors learn of the owner mentality and the sense of urgency that Roberto and his team have, that the company has a fighting chance to become one of the most respected companies in the industry. Its products and capabilities already have a top-notch reputation with customers, and we believe the company's capital stakeholders will soon feel a great sense of alignment with the ownership mentality that is trickling through the company. The opportunity remains substantial. It still has the cheapest valuation of its European peers. In fact, the valuation discount to peers remains wider than pre-COVID levels. Despite the performance achieved thus far, Leonardo's best days undeniably lie ahead. CTT. We could say the same for CTT, which is entering its 504th year as an organization. Operating profit is set to hit a company record in about a year's time, given the capital markets day guidance of 100 to 120 million in EBIT in 2025. Besides this figure being a new company record, what's more compelling is that the majority of it will be made up by profit drivers that didn't exist when we entered the boardroom in 2019. A highlight of the year for me was in December, when a union called a strike during the busiest moment of the year. Zero employees showed up for the strike outside of the six union leaders that called it. This strike was called just as a new customer satisfaction bonus scheme was in the early phases of being trialed. The company has been working on preparing data and processes for years to get to this point. It already has the leading position in on-time delivery in the entire market, but the company is pushing the bar even higher. While most employees feel a sense of ownership over the company and its brand, this incentive scheme will bring that commitment to a new level by continuing to prioritize the customer experience. This is also starkly contrasted to competitors that are owned by venture, government, or short-term oriented investors. A great example of this was in 2021 and 22 when VC-funded PAC, government-funded Carreros, and Royal Mail-owned GLS were attacking the Iberian market with price points that carried with them deeply negative gross margins. All three were fighting to dress up short-term results through unsustainable price points. As Royal Mail pulled the GLS IPO, Correos posted a negative result for its sole profitable segment of Express and Parcels, and PAC's venture funding evaporated. So has the sustainability of these competitors. As CTT held price and reinvested in quality of service throughout the heat of the moment, it has re-accelerated its market share conquests in the Iberian Peninsula. E-commerce ordering frequency in Iberia is still fractions of where it has hit in other developed markets, meaning the profit drivers from this core division are sustainable and secular in nature. Thus, the accelerated revenue growth rate demonstrated in recent results has sustainable profit drivers underpinning it. Furthermore, according to consensus estimates, EBITDA from 2023 will hit a new company record when it reports full-year financials. The stock remains 65% below its levels when it last reported a smaller number in 2016. The story is far from being over, and our suspicion is that a new record will not be the peak, as the company's medium-term guidance promises more by 25. The EBIT guidance of 100 to 120 million would support a market cap of 1 to 1.2 billion at peer valuations. These peers are not growing nearly as fast as CTT, so this is even conservative. The only question remains how many shares the company can retire between now and then from the current 138.9 million left. Every day that goes by with it trading for less than half of fair value means the share count will likely be considerably less. MEI Pharma. The ownership mentality is exactly what shareholders wanted to see at MEI Pharma in the wake of a failed merger attempt. I'm honored to have been named the chairperson of the Capital Allocation Committee, which includes finance professionals and owners with skin in the game. We are already hard at work ensuring that we live up to our mandate to maximize shareholder value, regardless of upcoming trial data the company's two remaining drugs generate. Trading at less than half of the cash on the balance sheet, we're not only excited by the opportunities in front of us, but are treating every penny of the companies with great care. We have strong alignment with the management of MEI Pharma that the two remaining drugs the company owns have a very high bar of success. We will behave like the owners that we are, and will look at each incoming data point with a rational and anchored perspective. I'm also reminded of our 2019 Investor Day, where we discussed the company's then three clinical programs with former CEO Dan Gold. Just after Dan left the stage to catch a flight, Dr. Phil Tetlock, author of Super Forecasting, reflected how the company's chance at success would likely come from the least expected place. As the recent book For Blood and Money reflects upon, sometimes the most forgotten parts of the portfolio can turn into a staggering success in the business. We will ensure that every penny of shareholders' capital is spent judiciously and opportunistically, and look forward to efficacy readouts in the months to come. I'd like to take this opportunity to publicly welcome Josh Pessis to the Greenwood team. We're so honored that Josh will contribute his over 20 years of investing in capital markets experience to both our firm and to our efforts to constructively engage with the second busted healthcare target. Josh is fastidiously finishing his diligence and working on our approach, and we are excited for his decades of healthcare experience will make its way into our portfolio in the near future. Hitting their stride. Rounding out the top five positions in the portfolio, which account for 69% of our exposure, net exposure, we're excited that Bellore and NextGen Energy are finally hitting their strides after a multiple year period leading up to a pivotal 24. While these are not new positions for us, and perhaps at times we may have sounded like a broken record discussing these investments while the stocks remain flatlined, 2024 will be a transformational year for both companies. NextGen Energy. In our view, the company's leading aerodeposit has the potential to be for uranium mining what Saudi Arabia is for oil, considering its economics. As uranium prices have now surpassed $100 per pound, using today's spot rate would mean that once Aero is fully operational, the free cash flow of the company will be north of $1.6 billion, with the fully diluted market cap today at a mere $4.6 billion. We would prefer to remain invested as co-founder and CEO Leigh Curyer builds his mine. Just as he discussed with us in his first Zoom with our investors a couple years ago, his priority has been first and foremost the company's people. Only after was it process-oriented, and then again, only after he got those two right did he focus on the project or the outcome. While we believe NextGen Energy will likely receive a takeover offer once the government of Canada fully approves its mine, we would prefer to not benefit from a quick takeout. Lay's style is exactly the mindset of other founder-managed companies have taken that have allowed them to outperform this market so materially. During the back half of the year, I discovered a relatively unknown book during a Zoom I had with Daniel Ek and the defense firm he founded, Helsing. Sitting prominently on the desk behind him was the founder's mentality. Mirroring a lot of the same themes that we have included in our white paper on owner-operators, I immediately devoured the work. The styles between founder and owner-managed businesses are nearly identical, yet for public markets, owner-managed businesses actually outperform founder-led companies considerably. While we view Spotify to be a very high-quality founder-led business with terrific growth prospects, its own valuation can't compete with Universal Music Group, which maintains more of a competitive advantage than any other player in the music industry. Bellore and UMG. As we recently wrote in our latest research note to investors, we believe the market is materially underestimating the growth trajectory of UMG as streaming companies implement a more artist-centric economic model. Given UMG dominates 70 to 80% of the top 10 charts and well over half of the top 50 streams, which generate half the music label's revenue, we believe UMG and its world-class talent will have the most to gain as this new economic model takes hold. With UMG already set to beat the consensus estimates over this year and the coming years, we believe more streaming services adopting the artist-centric model will bring UMG's revenue growth back to north of 20% over the coming years. That would allow operating income to more than double over the coming years, making it a high quality, high growth, and high margin investment that has zero exposure to the economic cycle. Of course, a better way to own UMG is through Bolloré, whose stock price is backed 118% by the fair market value of its UMG ownership. Each 10% move in UMG implies a 12% impact to the fair value of Bolloré's stock price. Given that all of the cyclical businesses have been sold over the past 2 years, the company has a war chest of cash, or €5.6 per net share, with 92% of the company's equity backed by a net cash position. With Bolloré trading at a 63% discount to its net asset value, comprised largely of publicly listed securities and cash, the biggest risk in Bolloré is that the family decides to take the company private at a healthy premium to today's stock price. We'd prefer to remain invested alongside Vincent Bolloré, who continues to buy back stock at less than half of NAV on a daily basis. Anchored by a highly attractive investment in UMG, we believe Bolloré is set to outperform the company with the strongest forward-looking growth profile in the entire music industry. Of course, for years, Bolloré and NextGen failed to keep up with market indices, which are increasingly being driven by a handful of highly valued technology giants. Owning them has required patience, but given both are managed by founders, we know that sooner or later, the founder will strike back and take advantage of this relative underperformance. Marked to emotion. Ironically, for a market that's dominated by machines, we see most assets being marked to emotion on a daily basis. The few humans that are left participating in daily trading appear to us to be more volatile than in past decades. Furthermore, knee-jerk reactions are being magnified by the machines that are doing most of the trading today. This has created even lumpier performance for most active managers than in the past. Higher volatility is, in turn, driving more investors to alternative asset classes that don't experience reported volatility like public market investors. Private equity investors like Brookfield have created major fortunes by taking advantage of the unwillingness of most investors to grin and bear volatile reactions. PDD. This herd-like mentality opened up two extremely high-quality investment opportunities for us in the back half of 2023. Using insights gleaned from our close proximity to e-commerce at CTT, we undertook a multi-month effort to underwrite PDD Holdings. This U.S.-listed Irish holding company owns China's leading disruptive marketplace called Pinduoduo. During the summer, as it became unbearable for most investors to remain publicly invested in Chinese equities, we took a position in PDD. During our diligence phase, a local Hong Kong investor that was invested in the company noted that Western investors should just stay away as they won't appreciate PDD's operating culture. He highlighted how the company gives no guidance, talks to no investors, and does not optimize its business for the short term. This means that quarterly earnings have often very large deviations from consensus, driving 20% plus moves in the stock. Paired with an extremely bearish market sentiment on Chinese equities, this combination became uninvestable for those in the Western markets. Adding to the narrative during the summer for PDD was that its international business, Temu, was burning cash and carried with it a negative valuation consolidated into PDD's holding company structure. Yet, as we were able to validate the major competitive advantage its direct selling model has, from Chinese factory direct to the global consumer, we understood the losses to be highly temporary as the company leaned into digital marketing, becoming by far the largest digital advertiser on all leading platforms. Temu has moved extremely rapidly to take over Shein in global commerce and global consumer wallet share, surpassing this highly valued yet private startup in shipment volumes in many markets we track. While investors that own Shein continue to mark their investment to a mythical level, Temu is rapidly curtailing the market opportunity that Shein had left in front of it. Yet because of quarterly earnings volatility, we were able to take a position in this promising startup at a negative valuation. Rentokil. A dramatic 30% share price fall in reaction to a profit warning at Rentokil triggered Chris's efforts to underwrite the pest control opportunity. In the merger integration with Terminix, one of the leading brands in U.S. pest control market, Rentokil had a marketing hiccup as teams transitioned. This caused the company to report lower organic growth than its highly valued compounder peer Rollins. which owns the Orkin brand. Terminix has suffered from five CEOs in the last decade as its private equity-dominated board constantly changed strategies to chase short-term profit bumps. This meant underinvesting in employee training in order to eke out higher near-term profit margins. Unfortunately, under this private equity leadership, this led to the company's net promoter score of negative 65. This is all music to the ears of Rentokil's owner-oriented CEO, Andy Ransom, who has publicly stated that the single thing that keeps me awake at night is colleague retention. Ransom joined Rentokil in 2008, later taking the reins in 2013, and immediately set about implementing his Right Way culture initiative. This strategy directly targets to improve employee and customer retention by investing behind employee training and fostering a positive people-first culture. Ransom admits, at its core, Rentokil's Right Way is actually about creating a culture that enables employees to take ownership and accountability while placing the customer first, which is crucial in the service business. This has led to Rentokil's earning numerous Best Workplace Awards in the UK, along with an industry-leading NPS of plus 48. Ransom admits that he has been stalking Terminix as an acquisition target for nearly a decade, but not until Terminix's most recent CEO, Brett Ponton, implemented an employee-focused strategy termed the Terminix Way. Was Ransom ready to act? While the integration of the two organizations is still in the early innings, Terminix employee retention is up over 500 basis points since the closing of the merger. We believe Rentokil's culture will help to bring additional progress towards further improving Terminix culture and operational processes. By continuously improving Terminix's culture, it should increase employee retention, which in turn will improve customer retention and thus significantly improve organic revenue and profitability. And this is all in addition to at least $200 million of net cost synergies benefit outlined from the merger. Due to the quarterly profit volatility making the company uninvestable for the compounder crowd, the business trades for 18 times 2023 earnings, and that is before significant synergies ripple through the income statement, which should push group margins to best-in-class levels. That compares to Rollins' 49 times earnings multiple, where the compounder crowd continues to herd. In short, we are pleased with the fundamental momentum of our portfolio generated in 2023. While our return outperformed the benchmark, they lagged the near 40% growth in free cash flow per share. Accordingly, our margin of safety has improved. The average free cash flow yield of our top five positions is a highly attractive 17.1%. While our portfolio's mark to emotion returns have outpaced broader indexes, we have not borrowed from the future like the indices have. We believe this bodes well for our forward-looking performance. Just like an owner-manager managing for both short and long term, we believe both outlooks are compelling. Furthermore, we have spent considerable time in the boardrooms ensuring the outlooks keep improving. So ignore your mark-to-myth portfolio. It doesn't reflect today's environment. A market-clearing portfolio is available today, and it has never been so attractive in the ponds where we fish. We could hardly be more excited for the year ahead. We look forward to growing your capital alongside ours. Committed to deliver, Stephen Wood. This is Silver Beach Q4 2023 letter. Silver Beach returned 27.7% for the full year 2023 net of fees in comparison to the S&P 23.7% return and the Russell 2000's 13% return. Over the last 3 years since track record inception, Silver Beach has compounded at a 22.1% annualized return, which equates to 12.8% annualized outperformance over the S&P. We are proud of our strong performance over the past 3 years and particularly proud of our index beating performance in 23. Last year was a challenging year for stock pickers to beat the S&P 500 as just seven companies, known as the Magnificent Seven, made an outsized contribution to the S&P 500's overall return, while a record 72% of individual companies underperformed the index. Today, we find the overall market to be rather overvalued. One might also expect Silver Beach's portfolio to be overvalued after a strong performance in 2023, but we do not believe it is. We have taken profits from many of our best performing investments and redeployed them into what we believe are even superior opportunities. As depicted below by Silver Beach's lower price to earnings ratio compared to the S&P, Silver Beach's portfolio is comparatively inexpensive but possesses similar growth and operating metrics. As a reminder, although our portfolio is optically cheaper than the S&P, we don't invest for the sake of cheapness itself. Our investment process balances valuation against quality and growth. We diligently execute this investment process to own a concentrated portfolio of attractive high conviction ideas, while the broader market passively allocates its capital across 500 companies. Throughout 2024, we expect the timing and scale of the Federal Reserve's interest rate decisions will have meaningful impacts on near-term asset pricing, as will sentiment around the upcoming U.S. election. Silver Beach is a fundamentals-driven investor, so we follow these consequential events with interest but remain focused on investing in companies that can win and outperform in the current environment and across unknown environments and outcomes, political outcomes. We are excited by our portfolio and opportunity set. The broader financials and real estate sectors were a fertile hunting ground for attractive investment opportunities in 2023. We expect our focus on these sectors, combined with our downside-oriented, high-conviction investment approach, to reward us in 2024 and the years to come. For this quarter, we have written about our investments in Brookfield and Energy Transfer Partners. Brookfield, BN. Brookfield Corporation is a high-quality business with an excellent investing track record that has amassed one of the world's largest discretionary pools of capital focused on managing and owning investments in infrastructure, renewables, real estate, insurance, private equity, and credit. BN offers investment products and services focused on these vehicles to institutional and retail clients through its asset-light investment management business named Brookfield Asset Management. BN owns a controlling 75% stake in BAM, Brookfield Asset Management, and both companies are led by Bruce Flatt. Bruce has been at Brookfield virtually his entire career, having joined the company at 25 years old. Bruce was made CEO in 2002 when he was 37. Bruce and other insiders are aligned with shareholders as they own over $10 billion of Brookfield stock. BAM is a scaled and high-growth business that has attracted hundreds of billions of capital in recent years due to its strong-performing investment funds. Brookfield's fee-bearing funds have grown from $138 billion in 2018 to $457 billion in 2023, or a 27% compounded annual growth rate. Approximately half of Brookfield's fee-bearing capital is also carry-eligible. Brookfield's carry-eligible capital has grown at an even more impressive 31% CAGR since 2018. Brookfield's BN's other holdings are numerous, more asset-intensive than the asset manager, and relatively complex by public market standards. We believe this surface-level complexity is partly responsible for BN's substantial undervaluation. We graphically depict a high-level overview of BN's holdings in the figure below. As you can see, BN has economic interests in several subsidiaries. Many of these holdings are also publicly traded. For example, BN has a 75% economic interest in BAM. In figure 2, we show that our estimate of Brookfield's of BN's intrinsic value is substantially above the company's share price. We construct a look-through estimate of the company's intrinsic value using public market valuations of BN's public subsidiaries and modest valuation assumptions for holdings that are not publicly traded. BN's own intrinsic value estimate is $82, a 100% or 105% premium to the company's share price at year end. As shown in figure 2, BN's shares sell at a substantial discount to management estimates of intrinsic value and our estimate of intrinsic value. We would not be interested in BN if it were simply selling at a discount to the implied value by its public subsidiaries. We also believe that the company's public subsidiaries are undervalued with embedded upside and are poised to outperform due to their high quality and constructive financial leverage. As interest rates rose in 2023, highly leveraged public company valuations were penalized. However, we believe Brookfield's public subsidiaries, high leverage, is well managed, and going forward, expect strong subsidiary operating performance combined with this leverage will result in increases to levered cash flows and accretions to equity value. We believe BN is an attractive investment because, one, leading investment track record. Brookfield's funds in infrastructure, private equity, real estate, and credit have leading track records across multiple vintages spanning decades of investing in different market environments. Since Bruce Flatt became CEO in 2002, Brookfield stock has compounded at a 19% CAGR despite recent underperformance. Two, high growth. Due to Brookfield's leading investment track record across the asset classes, fee-bearing AUM has grown at a 27% CAGR over the last 5 years, and carry-eligible capital has grown at a 31% CAGR. Three, misunderstood high-quality company. Brookfield has direct and indirect economic interests in several public subsidiaries and often exercises disproportionate control and governance rights over them. The public market's distaste for such holding company complexity results in an unreasonably large trading discount for Brookfield stock. Two, real estate and leverage misperception. When we speak with other investors about Brookfield, we usually hear concerns regarding the company's large commercial real estate portfolio of offices and malls. It is true that Brookfield owns a large portfolio of commercial real estate. This real estate is out of favor, and the market's perception is that Brookfield's continued ownership will hamper the broader company's operating performance for years to come. Digging just one inch deeper, it is easy to get comfortable with Brookfield's real estate exposure and leverage. Easily less than 20% of the company's EV can be attributed to its real estate portfolio. Attractive valuation. Brookfield trades at an unreasonably large discount to its look-through estimate of intrinsic value using valuations of its public holdings. We also believe Brookfield's publicly traded subsidiaries are undervalued. Energy Transfer Partners, ET. ET owns and operates the largest and most balanced collection of energy infrastructure assets in the U.S. ET's assets include 125,000 miles of oil and gas pipelines, export facilities on both the Gulf Coast and East Coast, and more than 1 million barrels per day of natural gas liquid fractionation capacity. ET accounts for 20% of worldwide natural gas liquid exports. Further, the company is uniquely connected to every major hydrocarbon basin in the U.S. By assembling energy infrastructure to gather, process, transport, and store hydrocarbons, ET connects exploration and production companies with the downstream end users such as gas stations, utilities, and export facilities. As an end-to-end midstream solution, ET enables its customers to focus on their portion of the value chain without the burden of significant but essential midstream logistics. ET services thus add tremendous value to all constituents in the marketplace. Though natural gas is a relatively clean source of fuel, restrictive federal and state regulations and other permissions severely restrict the building of natural gas pipelines and other infrastructure in North America that would help facilitate abundant hydrocarbon production. Pipelines are by far the cheapest and greenest method of transporting hydrocarbons. Pipelines reduce emissions from truck transport and reduce congestion on highways, rails, and shipping routes. Because of this restrictive environment, ET is in an enviable position with decades of growth ahead, secured by growing demand for American hydrocarbons. Though negative sentiment around the energy sector discourages many investors, we couldn't disagree more with their black and white approach to foregoing an investment in ET at today's low valuation. This is an opportunity to own essential infrastructure that facilitates global energy security and American leadership in the global transition from dirty hydrocarbons like coal to cleaner hydrocarbons like natural gas. We believe ET has an attractive investment is an attractive investment because, one, it's a high-quality business. Future cash flow should be relatively capex-light compared to ET's historical capex needs. The nationwide footprint has been built, and the company should be able to focus on accretive, high-return growth projects that further optimize ET's dense network. Only 10% of the company's expected EBITDA, 2023 EBITDA, is exposed to commodity price volatility. Manageable risks. Leverage. ET is optically highly levered at more than 4x net debt to EBITDA. However, the company is structured as an MLP and thus does not pay corporate tax. A tax-free corporate structure results in greater free cash flow conversion and leverage capacity. Shareholder alignment. In 2016, Kelsey Warren, the company's founder and executive chairman, was criticized for issuing convertible preferred units to himself and a small cadre of insiders. At a high level, these special units forewent dividends for a period in exchange for favorable conversion terms. Warren argued that skipping the dividends helped the company manage a high debt burden. The episode is a clear negative, but we think Warren is now aligned with shareholders. Today, there is only one unit structure, so management is on the same footing as regular investors. Plus, management owns 11% of the company. Capital allocation. ET has been a large acquirer of adjacent midstream assets. These acquisitions have significantly expanded the company, resulting in more complexity and constraints on management time. We believe ET's brightest days are ahead, and management's M&A strategy over the last 5 years will prove pressing and strategic. Commodity cycle and politics. Unlike E&Ps, whose revenue are directly linked to commodity price, ET's exposure to the commodity cycle is linked to production and volume. If, for example, American production of hydrocarbons is slowed, ET services would be lower in demand. For example, President Biden has intended to stifle American energy production and export, whereas President Trump promulgated American energy. We believe that commodity cycle risk and political risk are somewhat mitigated by the secular demand for hydrocarbons that underpin higher living standards and cleaner emissions. Third, secular tailwinds. ET benefits from secular trends in global and domestic demand for American hydrocarbons, particularly natural gas. North American natural gas export capacity should rapidly expand over the next 5 years so American producers can sell to an international market experiencing significant supply shortages. And attractive valuation. ET trades at an EV to EBITDA of 8x and 8x this year, 2023 estimates, and 7x 2024, and has a mid-teens free cash flow yield. We believe Energy Transfer's intrinsic value is more than 40% greater than its December 31st price. We'd like to thank all our investors for your trust and confidence. It is our great privilege to be your partner and to manage your capital alongside ours. Thank you for your referrals and capital introductions. We greatly appreciate your trust and conviction that this represents. James Holier and James Kovacs. This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor.
Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.